Hi, Marco Werman here. We've been hearing from so many listeners like you about how and why you listen to the world. How you listen? While walking your dog, making dinner, on your commute home, or with your students during a middle school history class you teach. Why? Because you value our diverse and broad perspectives. You appreciate the way that we find people at the heart of the news without doom and gloom, and how we provide insightful journalism and unique stories you won't find just anywhere. By now, you know we've set an ambitious fundraising goal before the end of the year. We have the chance to unlock a $67,000 matching gift, which will double your impact. But we still need 427 listeners to donate $100 each to get there. It sounds like a lot, but I know we can do it. We've done it before. And we need you. We won't get there without you. If you value our coverage, if you can't imagine your world without the world, please donate today. Every single gift will bring us closer to the goal. Visit theworld.org/give and donate today. That's theworld.org/give.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who exactly is Wise made for? It's made for Austrians in Australia, South Africans in Sweden. It's made for New Delhi, New York, and even regular York. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
The White House welcomes dozens of African leaders to Washington. Biden's envoy to the UN tells us it's not about competing with China.
While there is clearly a competition, we think the U.S. is ahead of the game.
Our conversation with Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Also today in Paris, e-bikes and scooters are taking over the city. A quick way to zip around, but with a serious downside.
It's very dangerous. There are a lot of accidents. In Paris, it's like the bordel, we said.
Bordel, it's a mess. I'm Marco Werman, plus uncertain times for the global economy.
I don't think we're in a worldwide recession at this point. You know, the $2 trillion question is if we're entering one.
Why the actions of the Federal Reserve in Washington make waves across the globe. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. Dozens of Africa's most powerful politicians are gathered in Washington this week. They're there for the three-day U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, which kicked off today. Vice President Kamala Harris welcomed attendees this morning, promising a partnership based on candor and openness.
Overall, our administration will be guided not by what we can do for Africa, but what we can do with Africa.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, is front and center at the conference. Earlier today, I asked her, what's the goal of the summit?
We really want to deepen and expand our partnership and to advance our shared priorities. We want to really amplify Africa's voice, both in our bilateral relationship, but also multilaterally. And then third, I think just to leverage the best of the United States. We're bringing the private sector in, we're bringing in civil society, we're bringing in our diaspora community that I'm going to be speaking with shortly. And really, our goal is to uplift our relationship with the continent.
Well, as you well know, China has long been Africa's big trading partner. Countries like Russia also have made inroads on the continent, selling arms and sending mercenaries. Turkey and the United Arab Emirates also have expanded their presence. What's Washington offering that's different?
You know, I don't know that we're different. We have been engaged with the African continent since the beginning. The U.S. was one of the first countries to recognize African countries who were gaining independence. If we go back even to Ghana in 1957. And we have never had a relationship of colonialism with the continent of Africa. We have been a strong supporter of human rights on the continent of Africa. African Americans, as well as others, were a strong voice of support for South Africa. China is new to this game on the continent. They've come to the conclusion that they need to focus attention on Africa because Africa is kind of the last frontier of resources and the last frontier of untapped possibilities. But what they are doing on the continent of Africa, as we see it, they're putting these countries in debt. They're providing infrastructure that many of us have seen that crumbles within a few years. They have a relationship, although they try to argue that it's a relationship of equal partners. We've all seen the extent to which they are able to threaten African countries, including using their debt as a weapon against these countries. Our relationship is really very different. It really is one based on partnership. It is one that is based on a deep and abiding support for the people of Africa. We do engage with governments. We know the importance of those bilateral relationships, but our relationship people to people is very different from what the Chinese have been able to achieve. So while there is clearly a competition, we think the U.S. is ahead of the game.
I mean, China has also brought many improvements to a lot of countries and some prosperity, which those countries are happy with. So is that going to change?
We're not telling Africans not to engage with China. We're not choosing their friends for them or their partners for them. What we're doing is reaffirming our relationship with the continent of Africa and the values that we present to the continent and the value of the relationship and partnership we have. If Africans make the decision that they want to engage with the Chinese, our goal is to help them get the best deal that they can possibly get, and they're not getting that right now.
Do you worry, though, that maybe we're entering an era of another great powers rivalry in Africa?
I don't think we are. I think we are in a place on the continent where Africans themselves know their value. They know their potential, and they're willing to work with countries, and particularly with the United States, as they've all indicated to us. They have a preference for working with the United States to build prosperity for the future. And again, it's going to be up to Africans themselves to decide that, but we're willing to partner with them.
President Biden is expected to announce $55 billion in initiatives for Africa over the next 3 years. During the summit, how can you be sure, Ambassador, that Washington does not put some of that money into the pockets of authoritarians and those who support them?
We have embassies and USAID missions in almost every country on the continent. And part of our jobs in embassies is to monitor and to ensure that the money that we're providing to countries actually go to the needs that have been identified. And I think we do an extraordinarily good job at that.
Will the president be meeting one-on-one with any heads of state during the summit?
He's going to be meeting with a number of leaders in group sessions. As you know, there are 49 leaders here, and we're looking for opportunities for him to engage with as many of them as possible during the summit.
And so how will the president parse out his messages to these various leaders? Because yesterday we spoke with a Ugandan opposition activist who argued that by inviting authoritarian leaders to this summit, and there are several of them of varying degrees of authoritarianism, the U.S. is sending the wrong message to pro-democracy activists in Africa. So what would you say about that?
You know, I think it's really important that we engage with those countries, even those ones where we have differences, because that gives us the opportunity to press them on those issues. I do believe that we will use this as an opportunity to deliver tough messages. You can't deliver a tough message if you're not engaging.
U.S. officials have been quoted saying President Biden supports both a seat for an African nation on the U.N. Security Council and allowing the African Union to join the G20 as a permanent member. What can you tell us about that, Ambassador, and why do you think it would make a difference?
This is part of our commitment. It is our showing to our African partners that we hear them. This is something that they've asked for, and we're responding to that.
Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, as you noted earlier, you've devoted a lot of your career to places in Africa, Kenya, the Gambia, Nigeria. You were the U.S. ambassador to Liberia. What sort of change are you hoping to see going forward when it comes to how U.S. leaders deal with their counterparts in Africa?
We have committed to engaging with this continent. And for me, I think the important thing that we will message in the summit is that we value Africa. And most importantly, we value the people of Africa. Africa is a young continent. The median age is 19, and we have to engage with those young people moving forward. Mm. They are the future, and we need to make sure that they're prepared for their leadership roles in the future and ensure that the United States is listening to them and supporting them and working so that they can provide for Africa's prosperity in the future.
Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. She joined us from Washington at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. Ambassador, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Marco.
If you live in a big city, you've probably noticed all those ride-sharing electric bikes and scooters zipping along. They make getting around a city faster and easier. There are also climate-friendly alternatives to gas-guzzling cars. So why are some cities trying to get rid of them? In Paris, reporter Rebecca Rossman took a ride to find out more.
Not since the automobile has a form of transportation been so revolutionary as the e-scooter, which can travel up to 30 miles an hour. So it sounds pretty smooth, right? I'm using Lime, one of Paris's three rental services. Using the app, I scan a QR code to unlock a scooter near my house at the top of a hill that shows the full Paris skyline.
I've been using Lime for, I would say, about a month now, pretty regularly because it saves me half the time. A 20-minute train journey takes me 10 minutes on a Lime bike, and they're fun. Maybe a little bit too fun.
All right, I'm going to have to stop recording here for safety issues. Which may be why this revolution goes bust just as it's taking off. For months now, Paris city officials have been at odds with e-ride sharing providers, primarily over safety concerns. There have been dozens of injuries in the last year alone, and four deaths, all tied to people using the e-ride sharing services. David Belliat is the Paris deputy mayor in charge of transport and public spaces.
C'est vraiment une jungle urbaine.
He says these e-ride sharing services have turned the city into an urban jungle. Last month, operators sent the city a list of proposed changes they plan on making, including adding license plates so police can track traffic offenses and adding ID checks to make sure all users are over the age of 18. They're hoping to convince the city to renew their contracts to operate in Paris, which expire next February. But David Belliat said proposals aren't necessarily enough.
Vous voyez bien qu'on a quand même là un sujet qui n'est pas qu'un sujet sur les propositions qui sont faites.
It's also about the responsibility of people using these apps, or rather the irresponsibility of the operators, he says. Yaronce Lefebvre is a senior director of public policy at Lime, which is one of the largest e-ride sharing operators in the world. She says popularity has skyrocketed since the pandemic. Just in Paris,
we have over 400,000 riders every month who use these services. For Lime, we see a 70% growth year over year between last year and this year in terms of usage.
She also mentions additional safety proposals Lime has put forward, including ride discounts for people wearing helmets and fines for those who don't park their bikes in designated parking zones.
If these measures and all the proposals that we have made to the city are implemented in Paris, it would make Paris the most regulated market, the most regulated city in terms of micromobility today.
The people I speak with along the Canal Saint-Martin, a popular spot for cyclists and scooters alike, say the city's concerns are legitimate.
It's very dangerous. There are a lot of accidents.
This woman named Juliette tells me a dense city like Paris with so many tiny streets just isn't equipped to accommodate so many scooters.
If we were in Denmark, for example, where you are a specific place for bike or
highway.
Yeah, exactly. It will be better, a bit better. But in Paris, it's like a mess because there is no place for, even for the bike.
Another woman, Charlotte, unlocks her bike as she tells me she's more concerned about the lack of respect e-ride users have for the rules of the road.
They feel like they are alone, no paying attention, no stop to light, no nothing. So even for bike, it's a bit dangerous.
But even with all the concerns, their overall popularity continues to skyrocket. Lime says one person uses their bikes every 4 seconds in Paris alone. The city says it will make a final decision on whether to proceed with a ban within the next few weeks. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
We hear a lot of languages in our newsroom and on our show. Just ahead, the effort to save one particular language from dying out and the international community that has rallied to the cause. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Here's a shocking stat about vanishing languages. We lose one every 2 weeks. When they die out, most take their secrets with them. If they're just spoken languages, they leave without a trace. But languages with rich histories and complex grammars, whose words are written down, those take longer to fade away. They stick around long enough for us to discover what's unique about them, which makes their loss that much more significant. One such language is Udi. Patrick Cox reports from a village in the Republic of Georgia, where Udi is spoken.
The village is called Zinobiani. It's in Georgia's wine country. Russia's only 10 miles away, on the other side of the towering Caucasus Mountains. On this evening, we pay a visit to Jenia Mamulashvili. She greets us in Georgian and a bit of English learned at school a long time ago.
It was 42 years before. I cannot remember.
Mamulashvili is a grape and hazelnut farmer. In her spare time, she writes poetry, much of it in the Udi language. Most of Mamulashvili's poems are personal and heartfelt, and this one's no exception, though it's not about someone she's ever met. It's about someone called Zinobi Silikashvili.
Zinobi is our man.
He was the founder of this village, and as far as the people here are concerned, the man who kept them together and kept them speaking Udi.
My maternal grandmother's uncle was Zinobi Silikashvili.
This is Alexander Kaftaradze, his great-great-uncle. Everyone today just calls him Zinobi. He was born about 120 miles from here in what's now Azerbaijan. The Udis had lived there for centuries. They'd even had their own kingdom in medieval times. But by the 1920s, they were a persecuted minority.
Some Udis thought that the only way to survive was to move somewhere else. And Zinobi led them here, and there were around 100 families that initially moved.
That was 1922. This month, the Udis are celebrating the centennial of their move to Zinobiani, named after their leader. The Udi language is still spoken by up to 20,000 people in a few communities scattered across Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia. But it's here in Georgia where the language has attracted international attention from linguists and historians.
The Udis themselves, their language was first written down, as far as we can tell, in the 4th, 5th centuries AD, after the advent of Christianity.
Thomas Weir is a linguistics professor who grew up in Texas and now teaches at the Free University of Tbilisi. That's Georgia's capital. A good place to study languages. About 50 languages are still spoken in the Caucasus region. Only three have their own alphabets: Georgian, Armenian, and Udi.
Just the fact that it does have this ancient written heritage is a very strong kind of talisman of their identity. It's something that makes them completely unlike the many other very interesting but different groups of the Caucasus. And so that's something that they can really hold on to.
And there's Udi pronunciation, too.
My name is Anna Ajikashvili.
Bajikashvili.
Ajikashvili, yeah.
I can't say that thing.
You know, it's really hard even for Georgians to say. Yeah,
That's a specific Udi sound.
Yeah.
Despite having a name that Georgians can't pronounce, Anna Bajikashvili only recently realized her linguistic heritage was different. What sparked it was the presence of foreign scholars in her home village.
When I saw first Americans and Europeans in Zinobiani, I became interested in, oh, wow, why are these people are coming here? What's the reason? Something in my inner said that it was important and worth to do something and to think about this, and I decided to make some things here.
She started lobbying the Georgian government to invest in the village. Now dirt roads are being paved, there are memorials to Zinobi and Udi culture, and Bajikashvili opened a guest house offering traditional Udi dishes. You may wonder what all this has to do with an ancient language in danger of dying out. But the visitors, the rebuilding, the memorials, they've changed Zinobiani. Fewer people are moving away, and some are coming back. Attitudes are changing too.
Many years ago, when I was a kid, it was kind of shame to say that you're Udi, because I remember from my school that my classmate, you know, laughed at me when I started talking about my nationality and my ethnical culture. And now it's becoming more and more popular, I think so, because people, some of them came here and asked me the questions, how can we arrange guest houses? Can you help us? We also want to see tourists here. And being Udi is becoming, I think, popular, and people are not ashamed.
There's another feature of the Udi language that people here have become proud of. It's a grammatical feature that some linguists believe is unique to Udi. It happens when you inflect verbs. We English speakers don't pay much attention to that. Most English verbs don't inflect as much as verbs in other languages.
So, for example, the boy kicks the ball.
Linguist Thomas Weir talks me through this. The word kicks consists of a root, kick, plus a suffix, the S at the end of it, that makes it kicks. That lets us know it's the third person singular.
Udi has person agreement like that too, but the suffix doesn't just stay stuck at the end like the S in English does. It moves around. It moves to other words in the sentence, and it can also move, be stuck into the middle of roots in Udi.
So that S at the end of kick, in Udi, it could end up right in the middle of the word, as in kisk.
That's something that linguists have always thought was completely impossible. Something that many theories have been written with the express desire to rule out that kind of possibility. And the fact that it exists in Udi means that it's a real possible thing, because we wouldn't even know languages could do that if we didn't know about Udi.
It's a poignant reminder of what may be lost every time a language stops being spoken. Udi looks like it's going that way. The village kids don't speak it. There's no immersion school to teach them the language. But Udi is continuing to be recorded and documented and heralded by its people, whether or not they speak it. Maybe calling Udi a dying language isn't quite right. Maybe it's someplace between dying and living. And maybe it's just as important that people revere the language. It's become a cultural artifact, a key part of Udi identity.
Halal Ashbal Insanyan, Kiziman di Udi Uchyan, Zinovi Papinach Bichorun Khash.
If you're wondering what happened to Zinobi after he led his people to Zinobiani 100 years ago, well, he was one of the millions of victims of Joseph Stalin. Georgia had become a part of the Soviet Union, and the Kremlin didn't tolerate strong-willed independent thinkers like Zinobi, says his great-great-nephew, Alexander Kavtaradze.
He was executed by the Soviets in 1938. Tragic story that was shared in our family. My grandmother would often remember this story. She was only a few months old when that happened, but she knew it from her mother and all the siblings.
To this day, Zinobi's spirit lives on among Georgia's Udis, not unlike the language they once all spoke. Not dead, but dormant. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
Patrick Cox is the founder and co-host of Subtitle, a podcast about languages and the people who speak them. More stories from around the globe, Dateline's Bali, India, and North Korea still coming your way. You're listening to The World. Laid-back tropical paradise is Bali's brand, so a new Indonesian law that criminalizes sex outside of marriage, that is definitely off-brand and has people in Bali's tourist industry worried and frustrated.
What is going to happen? And we're supposed to think about more important things in life.
A conservative law versus island hedonism coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today, the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, can breathe again. That's because the parliament there rejected the call for an impeachment inquiry. Marian Merton has been reporting on this story for South Africa's Daily Maverick. She joins us from Cape Town. So what happened in Parliament today, Marian?
Basically, the bottom line is the House voted against the recommendation of this independent panel that the president of South Africa should face impeachment inquiries. That's the boring version. All the excitement happened in the run-up to today's vote. We've had rumors and speculation about several ANC MPs bucking the party lines. The first ANC MP to stand up as a disciplined member of the ANC, I vote yes, i.e. in support of the recommendation for impeachment, was no other than Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. She is currently the minister in President Ramaphosa's cabinet, serving for cooperative governance, which in South Africa is basically liaison between national, provincial, and local government spheres.
Yeah, so within the ANC itself, within the president's own cabinet,
yes,
there was someone who wanted impeachment.
Correct.
I mean, really extraordinary. Lots of drama, but at the end of the day, no impeachment proceedings. Does that mean President Ramaphosa is totally in the clear now?
Yes, he is totally in the clear when it comes to action from Parliament. No, he is not in the clear when it comes to a number of other investigations.
So, Marianne, back up a bit and briefly explain the scandal that led to calls for Ramaphosa's impeachment in the first place. For those of us who are unfamiliar, this is all about Farmgate, right?
It is about Farmgate. It is about $580,000 on the president's account being stuffed in cushions of a sofa that's in a disused bedroom. And that detail we have from the president's own account. The theft happened in February 2020. It was not really reported, and it actually only came to light in June this year, more than 2 years later.
Marianne, it's just been a few hours since this news came from Parliament that they're rejecting the Farmgate report, no impeachment proceedings. How are South Africans reacting?
It really just depends on who you speak to. The reaction is broad and wide-ranging. Obviously, within the ANC, the official line is that it's a moment of celebration. The president has now survived this. Within the opposition ranks, if you speak, then questions are being raised and questions around the role of Parliament and Parliament's backbone of holding politicians and government to account are being raised. Literally, this is an issue that has deeply divided in many ways South Africans. I think one of the things that, for example, people will come back and say, but why is this a fuss? The president's own money was stolen. How is this important? Shame, it's his own money and he's a victim of crime. Other people will say, but how is it possible that somebody has $580,000, never mind stuffed in sofa cushions, but in his house? I don't think that this matter is out of the public discourse as yet, just because the ANC in Parliament has shut down this impeachment inquiry.
President Ramaphosa's party, the ruling party, the African National Congress, will meet in Johannesburg on Friday. What does the vote today say about the president's political vulnerability ahead of the conference?
I certainly think that his vulnerability has subsided and ebbed away. This was very important for Ramaphosa ahead of what we expect to be a very contested, very fraught ANC elective conference. So this vote today to basically say there will be no impeachment proceedings is good news for Ramaphosa.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, let's remember, though, the ANC, it's the party of Nelson Mandela, has a tremendous legacy. But in recent years, ANC leaders have been plagued by scandal. What does all this say about the ANC and its future?
If you were part of the opposition, it would be absolutely a signal that the ANC is not about renewal. The ANC keeps on putting party interests about South Africa over and above South Africa, and really quite a very dim and quite a negative view. And maybe it's important just to take a step back here, particularly when Cyril Ramaphosa was elected president in February 2018. He came in on this Tumamina, send me, I'm here to get things back on the right track. He's always styled himself as a constitutionalist, as somebody who believes in the rule of law. And unfortunately, unfortunately, even though the president has denied any wrongdoing, this Farmgate scandal has really cast a shadow over all of that and the governing ANC.
Marianne Merton reports for South Africa's Daily Maverick, updating us on the political fortunes of President Cyril Ramaphosa, who today dodged a threat of impeachment. Marianne, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
In Indonesia, a new law criminalizing sex outside of marriage has many people anxious, especially in Bali. Bali is unique among Indonesia's islands. Its population is mostly Hindu and religiously moderate. But Indonesia as a whole is a Muslim-majority country, with laws increasingly inspired by the Quran. The governor of Bali says tourists there should not worry about the new law. But as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, many in Bali are concerned about the law's impact on the island's reputation for freewheeling tropical fun.
Bali is more than a big, beautiful island. It's also a brand, promoted by Indonesia's tourism ministry. In ads put out by the government, Bali is all about lush jungles, foreigners in swimwear drinking out of coconuts, and of course, killer waves.
Release your inhibitions for an adventure of a lifetime.
But maybe don't release too many inhibitions, because anyone, citizens or foreigners, can now spend up to 6 months in jail if caught having premarital sex, 12 months if you're an adulterer. That's according to a new law that will take effect over the next 3 years.
What is going to happen? Are we supposed to think about more important things in life?
If Nilu Jalantik sounds frustrated, well, so are many Balinese folks. Nilu, who goes by her first name, is a former politician from Bali, also an entrepreneur running a fashion brand called Jalantik, and a prominent voice in Bali's business community. Hotel owners on the island are freaking out, she says. Tourists are already canceling holidays. Nilu is hearing about longtime visitors
who are afraid to come to Bali, who are scared to come to Bali because of this law, because they don't want to end up in jail, you know what I mean?
Bali's economy depends on tourists. Before the COVID pandemic, 6 million travelers were coming each year. That's a lot, considering there are only 4 million locals. Bali is now fully open and desperate to make up lost revenue. A law that scares away unmarried couples is not helpful. But its passage is also not shocking. Andreas Harsono of Human Rights Watch says that over the past decade, Indonesia has added hundreds of Sharia-inspired laws. I asked Harsono if most Indonesian Muslims are happy about the law against premarital sex.
I think so, because they might not understand the consequences of having this really bad law.
Already in parts of Indonesia, even before the law's passage, police units devoted to morality have barged into hotels and dragged unmarried couples out. The offenders are usually lectured, photographed, and made to sign a pledge, promising they'll be more chaste in the future. This has inspired some Indonesian hotels, usually smaller ones that don't receive foreigners, to demand marriage certificates from couples at check-in.
If you and your wife would like to enter that hotel, you have to prove that you are husband and wife.
But Harsono says he isn't worried about nationwide bedroom raids or cops bursting into Bali's tourist hotels. Because, under the new law, police cannot arrest couples unless one of their parents, children, or spouses files a report. Two foreigners on a beach getaway should be fine. A foreigner dating an Indonesian, better keep the family on your good side. Nilu Jalantik says meddling parents are going to love this law.
If I'm a mother, if I don't like the girlfriend of my son, then I can use this law to put someone in jail, you know? It's not cool, you know?
Indonesian justice officials say they are, quote, proud to have a criminal code in line with Indonesian values. But Nilu says this mindset worries the 10% of Indonesians who are not Muslim, Hindus like herself, plus Christians, Buddhists, and others. To Nilu Jalantik, Bali is all about religious tolerance. Hindus and Muslims working side by side, understanding that some people eat halal and some people love babi guling, the signature dish of Bali, a roast suckling pig. Nilu says she just wants to make sure
that Bali will stay Bali, that we still have baby guling. We were going to still have bikini on the beach. And whoever wants to change that is going to have to face me.
In the meantime, Nilu wants tourists to understand that outside of unusual circumstances, this law won't affect them. Come to Bali, she says, and have a good time. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
During these pandemic years, I'm guessing you, like I, have often relied on friends to make it through, even when you're separated by walls or oceans. On an upcoming special edition of the show, we're looking for stories about helpers, people who've made a difference for you when times are tough. We want to hear your story. Send us a short voice memo telling us about the person who came through for you and how they made a difference in your life. Include your name and location and send your voice memo in an email to myworld@theworld.org. We might feature your story on the show. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. The Federal Reserve is widely expected to raise interest rates again tomorrow, this time by half a percentage point. That's smaller than recent hikes. A sign that inflationary pressures may be losing steam, but still not getting us where we need to be. The Fed's actions are focused on helping the U.S. economy. What it decides in Washington, though, that's felt far and wide. And now parts of the developing world are dealing with the consequences, more countries feeling the economic pain, in large part because much of the world relies on the dollar to trade goods and services.
So movements in the dollar affect countries all over the world. And interestingly, when there's trade between, say, Germany and Japan, that trade is invoiced in dollars, not in euros or in yen.
That's economist Michael Klein from the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's also the executive editor of EconoFact, a website where economists break down complex economic topics. I asked him why a strong dollar, which is the case now, hurts emerging markets.
One way is that commodities all around the world are priced in dollars. So with the war in Ukraine, there's been an increase in the dollar price of commodities. But then layered onto this is an increase in the value of the dollar. So these commodities become even more expensive for emerging market countries. Another problem is that if companies in these emerging market countries have borrowed in dollars, which is often the case, so it becomes more difficult for these companies to pay back the debts.
Yes. So is there much that an emerging market country can do to counteract what the Fed in Washington decides, or are they more or less at the mercy of a few central bankers in the U.S.?
Well, it's very difficult for emerging market countries to buck the tide of what's going on in the wider world. They have typically sort of thin financial markets that can be buffeted about. There are things that it can do to protect itself, like having a bigger what's called war chest of foreign reserves, making sure that its own domestic situation is good, that it isn't running big budget deficits.
And let's just back up a moment, Michael. Remind us what factors have led to this global inflation.
Inflation had been quite low for a long period of time up until about 2019 or so. This has been called the Great Moderation. And then when COVID hit, initially economies locked down, but then the supply chain issues led to an increase in the prices of goods. And then there was a lot of government support, not just in the United States, but in other countries as well. And as people started to spend this money, this also drove up demand. And then finally, the war in Ukraine increased the price of energy and the price of food, and that also contributed to inflation.
So I know this is hard to measure, and there are debates on what technically counts as a recession, but I'm going to ask you, are we in a worldwide recession? Are we entering one? Where are we at?
Well, I don't think we're in a worldwide recession at this point. You know, the $2 trillion question is if we're entering one. Central banks around the world are raising interest rates to fight inflation. And it's a very hard line to walk to bring down inflation without causing a recession. And the fact that it's a worldwide inflationary episode means that all these central banks are doing the same thing at the same time, which could help tip the world into recession. But inflation, you know, if it's not addressed, could really start to accelerate.
So how does a country caught in recession start to work its way out right now? I mean, normally the government primes the pump, borrows money, injects it into an economy to prop things up. But when interest rates are high and getting higher, is that an option?
Well, if there is a recession, central banks might start to soften their stance and, you know, not raise interest rates further, perhaps even lower interest rates. But we should also be cognizant of the fact that part of what's going on now is this tremendous supply shock because of the increase in the price of oil and the increase in the price of other energy sources due to the war in Ukraine, and also the food price inflation from that as well. In Europe especially, this has been a really big problem because Europe is much more dependent than, say, the United States on energy sources from Russia. So the real challenge is that central banks and even fiscal policy can affect the demand in an economy, but they do little to affect supply, especially in the short run. So the tools that we have to fight recession are a little bit blunt and maybe not the best things that are available at a time of a supply shock.
Michael Klein is a professor of international economics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Thanks for explaining, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Glad to do so, Marco.
A few months back, an American foreign policy analyst received an email supposedly from North Korea expert Jenny Town. Town said she wanted to pick the analyst's brain. Nothing too out of the ordinary so far. But when the analyst reached out to Jenny Town directly, it was perplexing because Town had not initially reached out to them. Turns out the original email came from a North Korean spy. Jenny Town is with us to discuss this increasingly common technique. She directs the Stimson Center's 38 North program, which provides analysis of North Korea. Jenny, we've had you on the show before. You're a solid and reliable expert on what's happening in North Korea. Then this happens. What was your reaction when Daniel DePetris, the foreign policy analyst, received an email signed by you, got in touch?
Like you said, it was actually very perplexing because he had messaged me on Twitter and had told me he had some questions. And so I kept waiting for his questions and they never came. And he was like, oh, no, we talked about it this morning. And it's like, no, we didn't.
Were other North Korea experts also impersonated or is it just you?
There's several of us, probably about a handful of us that I know of. Me, one of my colleagues, a couple other people who frequently do events. I guess the North Koreans have figured out who people are likely to respond to, where this would be a very normal ask. In the past, actually, they would impersonate being reporters and ask for, you know, written out interviews. But in those days, the North Koreans would basically use like a Word document that was password protected. So it was much more obvious that this wasn't a real interview request, but they would basically intercept some interview request, copy and paste it, and then change out like one line in it and pose then, you know, these questions to people throughout the community to get their thoughts on it.
Yeah. So impersonating someone is not a new tactic, it seems, by North Korean intelligence, but it is saying like, I'm Jenny Town. Is that a step up in sophistication or aggression?
The difference now is that in the past, they used to pose as this and have actual, like, try to plant malware on your computer through these documents. Now they're just asking us for papers.
I mean, are there any giveaways in these emails that make them detectable as clearly North Korean, or are they really well executed?
They're really well executed now. In the past, there used to be some bad grammar and, you know, typos and things that would really set off the alarm bells. But now, you know, the grammar is good, the request is plausible. But there was one set of emails that was going out under my name that, you know, would start with the greeting line of "Dear Gents." And I would, of course, never call anyone that. And it was going to both men and women. So the women, of course, were like, wait, what is this? And so I'd get a lot of text messages of like, did you just send me this weird, you know, request? And I was like, no.
So do we know whether anyone has fallen for this email scam and responded with analysis or information?
Absolutely. And the reason why they're able to send out, you know, papers for review, for instance, is because they've gotten people to write papers for them. And they're real papers. And they're real papers that people wrote expecting to get published somewhere that never get published, that are just used as bait, you know, to engage other experts in the community. Somewhere down the chain, once this relationship is established, there may be a document at some point or a link at some point that they send that will have malware. But that is less common now than it used to be. Now, I think they've just figured out if they pose as the right people, they can ask the questions that they want and people will answer them.
And it is fairly certain or 100% certain that there's a connection to Pyongyang?
Yes.
Have any U.S. counterintelligence agencies been in touch with you about this?
Yes.
And can you share with what they're interested in knowing?
a lot of it is just investigations into trying to trace back the actors to, you know, what departments are they coming from, where are they located. A lot of the counterintelligence are not only investigating who these actors are, but then also trying to get the email servers to shut down those addresses so that they can't be used.
What's the discussion been like among you and other North Korea experts in the wake of all this?
Really, we're all on a high level of due diligence and vigilance. And when we get emails, you know, where did the email come from? Is it really the institutional email? Is it the right email address? If there's anything that feels off about it, you know, how to contact each other outside of the email.
So aside from that initial kind of connection being really perplexing, what does it feel like to be someone whom North Korean intelligence wants to impersonate?
For me, you know, it's become very common. I know some colleagues get really angry about it. And some colleagues see it as sort of a rite of passage of like, oh, I'm well enough known now that I'm influential enough to use my name.
You've been through the hazing, you're in.
Yeah.
Jenny Town directs the Simpson Center's 38 North program, which provides informed analysis of North Korea. Jenny, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Also from the Korea Security Desk, news about BTS. Today, the oldest member of the K-pop supergroup arrived at military boot camp. Jin showed up for basic training in Yeoncheon near the tense North Korean border, welcomed by a few dozen well-wishers, even though he'd asked fans not to show up. Authorities mobilized 300 police officers, soldiers, and emergency workers, you know, just in case BTS mania broke out. Enlistment by the K-pop idols prompted a fierce debate about South Korea's conscription system. South Korean men must serve in the military for 18 to 21 months. As of today, that includes Jin, who posted a photo of his fresh military buzz cut. He added, "It's cuter than I'd expected." Yeah, I'm sure his fans agree. We are coming down to the end of the year, don't you know? And that means taking stock of many things, including all the great music that came out across the globe over the past 11 plus months. There was a lot. The world, as in this show, is taking stock, and we'll have our faves pulled together in an end-of-year playlist. Be on the lookout for that. In the meantime, our show director, April Peavy, has her best of list already compiled. This is one of her favorite releases from 2022. This track, Aizu Bandai-san, is from an album called Wamono Groove, Shakuhachi and Koto Jazz Funk 76. It's a collection of jazz from 1970s Japan with a focus on those two instruments, the well-known stringed koto and the Japanese flute you're hearing, the shakuhachi, played here by Kifu Mitsuhashi, a master of the instrument now, who is just starting to do the jazz thing in the 70s. Funk side of this album, pretty obvious. You almost wonder if this track was ever part of a 1970s Japanese cop show. Music from the album Wamono Groove ends our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Be safe and stay strong. Thanks for listening. Hi there, Marco here. Before we go, we are nearing our deadline to unlock a $67,000 matching gift, and we need your help to do it. If you value the world's human-centered coverage, and if you can't imagine your world without the world, please donate today. Visit theworld.org/give. Thank you very much, and be well.